Hey guys, welcome back to Skincare Anarchy. This is your host, Esha, and I'm very excited because this is another episode in the Masterclass with Codex Labs, and we have the amazing Dr. Barbara Paldies with us again today. Welcome back to the show, Barb. I'm so excited to continue this.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here with you.
Yeah, I mean, last time we discussed, you know, DNA testing, and I know Codex came out with some amazing DNA tests. So for everyone listening, if you haven't caught that episode yet, make sure you tune into that and check out the actual tests themselves. It's really phenomenal what Codex is doing. But Barb, we talked about that last time, and I would love to learn about what's new at Codex.
I think it's been like almost 6 months, Ekta. So yeah. Now we're focusing more and more on how the skin gut brain. Yeah, I know you're probably going, skin gut brain. Axes influence our skin problems. So it's not just about the surface of the skin. It's really the impact of inflammation, the skin gut microbiomes that we touched on last year. And we're finally close to having a complete solution for acne and some really exciting clinical results I'm going to share with you today. But what's even cooler is that this concept applies to many other skin conditions. So there's a ton of future work to do here.
Yeah, no, that's really fascinating because, yeah, this topic, I think it comes up in a very superficial way most of the time. So, like, I'm really excited to talk to you about the data, really. And so let's just dive in. You know, I want to talk about the microbiome, if you don't mind. If you could remind us, you know, what is the microbiome and where should we be really starting our, you know, our knowledge for understanding what the microbiome is?
Absolutely. So I think more and more people are now talking about the microbiome, and it's essentially characterized by vast populations of diverse microorganisms, things we can't see. And it's present in many ecosystems, so not just our human body, but these complex communities are bacteria, fungi, viruses, yeast, molds, archaea, a bunch of things we probably don't even know yet. And these microorganisms often play key roles in balancing or driving our biochemical processes. And what's always fascinating to me is that the microbiomes, for example, in our gut, on our skin, in our mouth, on our scalp, vaginal microbiomes in women are all completely different. And when I was kind of looking at numbers, this maybe might put it into context for your listeners, but our average microbiome contains about 10 to 100 trillion microorganisms, which is more than the 400 billion stars that we estimate make up the Milky Way. So on one body in the gut, there's more microorganisms than all the stars in the Milky Way.
Wow. That's insane. It's crazy to think about that we have an entire ecosystem, you know, living like on us and in us, like at all times.
It's and not more than 99% of our genetics are the microbiome bacteria. It's not even our own genetics, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, I know for me, the gut microbiome is the most interesting, you know, and I would love to take a closer look at that. If you could tell us about maybe some of the bacteria that are found in the gut and some of the keystone organisms.
Absolutely. So the gut microbiome is what I would say is probably the most studied scientifically at this point in time. And it's, again, a very dynamic ecosystem in our intestinal tract. And without it, we can't digest. It affects our immune system, our hormonal balance, absorption of nutrients. And so you mentioned some of the key organisms. So there's the kind of bigger groups. So there's the bacteroides. These are very widespread types of bacteria. Their role is really the digestion of complex carbohydrates, keeping our energy equilibrium, and then basically balancing both our gut and systemic immune response through T cells. And they actually regulate the size and the function of the T cell population. So really, they're the ones who help the integrity of that mucosal lining without which we get allergens and viruses in our blood and immune reactions. And then there's the Firmicutes, which also contain, so that's kind of the other major group other than this bacteroides. And they're the most common microbial strains. And so they include things like lactobacillus, for example, that we all know is in yogurt, but is also in our guts. And they're responsible for producing a short-chain fatty acid called butyrate. And that's really important for the health of the cells, again, on the inner surface of the intestinal wall. And they're also involved in fiber-rich food digestion. And what's important for our health, actually, is the ratio of these Firmicutes to the bacteroides. And changes in this ratio have been associated now clinically with things like obesity or metabolic disorders. So again, this biosis or not having dysbiosis, having a balance in the microbiome is really important. Then I'm sure people have heard of E. coli, you know, when there's like outbreaks of E. coli with people, those cause infection in the gut. But if you don't have too much E. coli, they're actually harmless and they're really important in synthesizing vitamins like B12 and K. They also help prevent colonization by other kinds of pathogens. So, you know, bad bacteria can play a good bacterial role. That's what's so fascinating about, you know, it's all relative and the relative concentration of that bacteria. Then there are things like bifidobacteria. So these are the bacteria that help us ferment the indigestible carbohydrates like fiber. things like B vitamins and lactic acid, which are also really important. And they also help maintain, again, that balance in the immune function. And then lately, we've been hearing a lot about aging and acromantia. That these bacteria live in the mucus layer, and they help break down sugary proteins called mucins. And so generally, again, that's to strengthen that intestinal barrier and modulate insulin resistance. So you can imagine, are they implicated maybe in diabetes, and also protect from metabolic inflammation. But again, if they come out of balance, they can also damage the gut barrier. They can cause inflammation, and they can actually disrupt recovery after antibiotics. So all of these bacteria play different roles, and they can, you know, too much is not good. Just the right amount is what keeps us healthy. And they're, most of them are commensal, so they're required for our health. They also need to be present in certain population sizes where there are enough of them to balance each other out so that they can work harmoniously together. But what also always fascinates me is that, say you lost your gut microbiome for about a month, you would starve to death. Or die of infection. That's crazy to me. So our gut microbiome's healthy and balanced.
No, absolutely. I think that's something very interesting to me that you brought up the balance component, because I know we hear about that a lot, you know, in like very, you know, general sense, but like the things that you were mentioning in terms of what's actually being created by these bacteria, you know, and how that's playing this role in this like interconnected nature of what's actually going on in that environment to make sure that the integrity of your gut is intact. You know what I mean? And that all of these things are happening for a reason. I think that's something that consumers and even anybody, right? No matter what your background, it's hard to wrap your head around that, is that it is truly an environment. You know, everything is feeding off of itself. And, you know, when I look at it from the clinical standpoint, I mean, the big thing that comes up is when you eradicate your gut, you get things like, you know, C. diff, overgrowth, right? That's what we hear about the most in terms of clinical. But then, you know, we don't know what that means in terms of the long term. You know, you can then treat an infection of C. diff, but then you don't know what that means for recolonizing and making sure that things are coming into balance again. So that's a very interesting point. I wanted to actually discuss like this thing that you had brought up earlier, which was the gut skin brain axis. If you could tell us a little bit more about that, you know, and dive into it more, like what does it really mean for our overall skin health, you know, understanding this gut microbiome?
Absolutely. So the skin gut brain axis is really what we're now using scientifically to start explaining correlations, for example, between the gut microbiome and also emotional states or systemic inflammation in the body, including skin inflammation. And so there's more and more belief now in research that a lot of the skin disorders, so for example, eczema or acne, are now thought to originate in the gut microbiome. And it's really, as we were talking about, these disturbances in the mucosal lining or imbalance in the microbiome or also overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine can all manifest as rashes or flares on the skin, or even some of these onsets of the skin diseases, such as psoriasis, can be triggered by, you know, the inflammatory cascade from this dysbiosis. And so what's interesting is that kind of the more recent studies, say in the last 10 years on the gut-skin axis, show that most of these diseases are in fact associated with this altered gut microbiome, and that both the inner surface of the gut and the outer surface of the skin, so you can think of it as the surfaces of our body that are exposed to the outside, have the same types of epithelial cells. And that's what directly contacts these microbes in the microbiome. And so really the gut epithelial barrier regulates the uptake of fluids, electrolytes, nutrients, prevents pathogens, right, coming in through our gut and through what we eat. So then this gastrointestinal dysfunction and imbalance in this intestinal microbiome causes this excess bacterial growth, pathogens coming in, and that means competition for nutrients and toxin metabolite production. So this basically causes inflammation. And then the inflammation affects the physiology of the skin. So leaky gut means leaky skin. And in fact, as early as 1930, so we can go back almost 100 years, and there were two very well-known American dermatologists, Stokes and Pillsbury, and they were actually the first to publish a connection between gut and skin and actually the nervous system through depression, because they were studying acne, and they were actually the first to propose a probiotic. And in this case, it was Lactobacillus acidophilus, the one that's used to make yogurt. And they used it for the treatment of acne, and they published for the first time that they saw improvements. They improved the gut microbiome, and so they improved the skin. They also observed, interestingly, that anxiety makes acne worse. And today there are more and more studies on the linkage between anxiety, depression, and acne breakouts or psoriasis breakouts, et cetera. So that's a whole different topic, is the skin brain, and it goes through the gut. So that's why we always say gut, brain, skin. Also now we're starting to see more and more research on gut microbes and oral probiotics being linked back to acne severity and their ability to influence mood. Again, inflammation, oxidative stress that we've talked about so much in skin barrier, glycemic control, right? Or eating too much sugar or not being able to process all that sugar, as well as lipid content and high fat diets. So really this relationship between the gut and the skin, it's not just, you know, the microbiome, it's also diet, which is now also being studied for a lot of these skin disorders, also for eczema, psoriasis, not just acne. And this research, I think, will continue to indicate that this gut-brain-skin axis controls our overall health. And pretty much we're all unique again. It goes back, just like with our genetics, everyone has a unique microbiome. And we don't necessarily know what's healthy, because some people may have completely different balance levels and they're perfectly healthy. And that same level might make another person sick. So, but it's very interesting to start linking also the psychological aspects and the neurotransmitter aspects with flare-ups, for example.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think, you know, it always, like, you know, leads me to endocrine, you know, like personally speaking, like I always think about, you know, we always talk about these hormone fluctuations, especially when it comes to acne and teenagers, you know, we discuss hormones a lot, you know, and how they play a role. But then everything you're explaining now is just making me think of, well, is it really like a brain thing, or is it more of just like this endocrine disruption that happens, you know, at the end of the day? That's, yeah, it's very interesting. But you brought up something interesting about the you know, role of diet and all of this. And I know that a lot of times doctors will recommend adolescents to, you know, who are dealing with acne, to reduce their consumption of things like sugars, high fat foods, you know, processed snacks and fast food, all of that. So, you know, there's then a big correlation, right, between what we're eating and this skin gut microbiome axis. And I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I think you're absolutely right there. And we're learning more and more about it. And we're learning more the details and the mechanisms of that. So yes, acne, as we all know, it's inflammatory skin lesions. You know, we can call them pimples, or more technically papules or pustules, as well as comedones, which are non-inflammatory, and combinations, like people get combinations of blackheads, whiteheads, pimples, et cetera. And there are now more and more studies showing gut dysbiosis and acne. And for example, a recent study was looking at the commensal, like these actinobacteria that we talked about, the bifidobacteria and lactobacillus species. And they were looking at basically people with acne, and they tended to have lower concentrations or populations of these types of beneficial bacteria and increased abundance of pathogenic types like proteobacteria. And so it's now being hypothesized that, for example, this gut dysbiosis leads to the overproduction of the oiliness, the sebum, which then plugs the pores and then allows the cutibacterium, this non-oxygenated environment, to kind of exponentially grow and create pimples. But there are now studies showing that, you know, a high glycemic or sugar load index can influence acne, because there's certain insulin signaling in the body that, you know, this overconsumption of sugar can lead to. And that triggers, going back to our genetics, a gene called FOXO1 that stimulates a complex called mTORC1. And that has been demonstrated to be associated with acne development. So we're now finding the links through the triggers of various genes, through the insulin signaling in the body, that are tying back acne with sugar consumption. And same with the high fat diets. There, basically, it's more through the gut microbiome. So these Firmicutes, if you remember that we're talking about the ratio.
Yep.
So when you eat a high fat diet, you increase the growth of these Firmicutes and you increase their ratio to the Bacteroides. Remember how we were talking about how that can also lead to obesity? But basically, by eating a high fat diet, you change your ratio, and that then alters your cytokines, which again are immune basically response, and that promotes inflammation, and then that causes inflammation in your hair follicles, and the hair follicles overproduce oil, and you're back to that acne cycle. The other interesting thing is some acne patients have been found to have low levels of stomach acid. And so that's interesting, because those low acidity levels allow bacteria from your colon to migrate into your small intestine. Again, goes back to the imbalance, this intestinal dysbiosis, overgrowth, and then that increase the permeability of your gut and go back to inflammation and inflammation of the skin and acne. So while we don't exactly know, like, how these ratios of, you know, gut microbiota are truly impacting acne. What we do know is that these imbalances definitely lead to acne.
Wow, that's really fascinating that you really got into that gastric acid thing. That I didn't know that. That's very cool. I mean, I think, you know, it makes me think because a lot of times, even what we're ingesting, you know, a lot of the bacteria that might be harmful to our bodies usually die because of the gastric acid. So it just makes me think of like, you know, it, like we're talking about food. If you're eating something that's like colonized with, you know, the wrong bacteria, which happens all the time, you know, even if it's not ridiculous, like, you know, what we hear about, it can still impact, right? If those bacteria survive. So that's very fascinating that you mentioned that.
And what's really weird is like, if you look at yogurt, like ironically, yeah, like the lactobacillus, you have to have a higher fat yogurt and you have to have some sugar in it because they use the sugar and then they cloak themselves in the fat in the yogurt to survive your stomach acid. Like, it's just crazy.
Oh,
like,
wow.
So yeah, low-fat yogurt with no sugar probably would not have a probiotic effect.
Wow. Yeah. So what is it then? I want to ask you then, you know, about the antibiotics versus probiotics, because I think this is a big, you know, topic, and there's not a lot of clarity for me, at least. Like, you know, could you explain that to us a little bit more?
Sure. So basically, both of them change or modulate your gut microbiome. So basically, any mechanism that modulates your gut microbiome can have either a positive or negative impact on acne or, you know, other skin conditions. And so that means really we were talking about diet. So we pretty much covered this. But, you know, also I should probably mention like synthetic products, additives and supplements can change the gut microbiome and lead to inflammation. And so eating a lot of processed food can worsen acne. Or if people are lactose intolerant and they have a diet with a lot of dairy products, that can also trigger acne. So that's usually why our dermatologist tells you don't eat sugar, don't eat too much high fat, and avoid milk products. But antibiotics, essentially, they're used to treat acne, and their main target is really to eliminate infections. So as you were mentioning earlier, you know, C. difficile can overgrow and then you need fecal transplants. But usually, you know, for overgrowth, antibiotics are prescribed to just kill everything. And they also have, you know, anti-inflammatory and immunomodulatory benefits, but they're usually used to treat moderate to severe acne over a 4 to 6 month period. The problem is these tetracycline, you know, minocycline, doxycycline, or erythromycin, azithromycin prescriptions, they basically kill everything in your gut. And so then you have to rebuild your gut microbiome in order to get your digestive system back. And so there's now a new antibiotic called sarecycline, which I think is used in the UK. I don't know if it's used in the US yet, to treat moderate to severe acne, but it has specificity for C. acnes. So again, antibiotics are kind of like the nuclear bomb. And they kind of wipe out the entire gut microbiome, and then they can lead to other chronic health problems. So, and the other chronic health problems can also have an impact on your skin. The other issue is if we overuse antibiotics to treat acne, like there's basically 3 million cases of acne in the US, just in the US, think of the antibiotic resistance that were causing other pathogens, right? So it's not just beyond, you know, using antibiotics and the effect on your own gut, but it's just the overall, you know, what are we doing if we're treating 3 million cases that may not need antibiotics with antibiotics and causing other pathogens to become antibiotic resistant?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's so a valid point, because I feel like every medication you had listed off, like all I have ever thought about when I see these antibiotics was like broad spectrum. You know, like, why are we using such broad spectrum? Like, you know, we need more targeted therapy. So that's very interesting that you mentioned that new drug. I mean, I would love to see that more emerge in dermatology. You know, it's one thing. It's cool that we're using antibiotics to obviously target acne, but then it makes you wonder, like, you know, if you're systemically administering anything, you have to think about every, you know, all of the other bacteria, you know, it's like almost illogical at this point, you know, where we've come to now with modern medicine to do that. It's, you know, now that we understand that bacteria everywhere, these kind of medications and therapies need to be reevaluated, I think. You know, that's my personal opinion, but very, very fascinating. I'd love to see that drug, you know, if it is being used in the UK to come over here, because I haven't seen it personally, but
Right. And the problem is it's a 4 to 6 month treatment, right? This isn't like just you take it like azithromycin for a week, you get rid of the infection you have. This is a long-term antibiotic treatment. And this is where prebiotics and probiotics might actually play a role. And I think that's where we need to start looking at from a research perspective. You know, prebiotics are the non-digestible carbs, you know, they support your overall gut microbiome. And then the probiotics are the gut bacteria themselves. And so I think from research, we're starting to see, for example, anti-inflammatory bacteria like lactobacillus or bifido that helps balance basically this dysbiosis may actually have results that are comparable to antibiotics. And so if we can treat acne with probiotics versus antibiotics, then it's like a double win, right? There's no antibiotic resistance. And it's also way easier on the gut because you're actually restoring that balance of the gut that's already in dysbiosis rather than just saying, I'm going to wipe everything out and then rebuild it.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, you had mentioned that you have recent clinical study data on your acne supplements. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. So this is our Clear Skin probiotic that we developed for mostly bacterial acne that is based on gut dysbiosis. And that's so we looked at 8 weeks of usage and we counted acne lesions. And what's really cool is that we saw a reduction in acne lesions of 58% over 8 weeks, which is actually comparable to antibiotics. So that's why I have a lot of hope for probiotics. And that uses the lactobacillus. So this is, which occurs naturally in the human gut, as well as, you know, fermented foods, sauerkraut, yogurt. But that's an anti-inflammatory bacterium that increases levels of an anti-inflammatory cytokine called IL-10. And it's also been demonstrated in the literature to improve acne. And then we combined it with Bifidobacterium lactis or Bifidobacterium bifidum, which is shown to keep these pathogenic microorganisms in check and really support the immune system by its immunomodulatory effects and also influence inflammation triggering glucose levels. So remember those sugar levels? So this also helps with those sugar spikes. And then the last one is Bacillus coagulans. That's a spore-based probiotic, again, with anti-inflammatory properties, but also it helps lower blood lipids. So it goes back to that high-fat diet. So for teenagers, for example, where you can't control their diet, this is actually designed to help offset some of those bad habits because you can't necessarily control every chocolate bar or every time they go to McDonald's. And so, you know, we basically help their gut. And then there's also two antioxidants here from Ayurveda. So one is Google, which contains Google sterones, and those have been shown to actually reduce blood lipid levels and lower blood sugar levels. So again, addressing that dietary issue. And Google sterones are known in the literature to decrease acne, comparable to actually tetracycline, which is one of those antibiotics. The other ingredient is EGCG, which comes from green tea. So this, you know, it's a mouthful, you know, apigalactocatenin gallate. That's basically an anti-inflammatory. That's also been shown in clinical studies to reduce acne. So we pretty much packed everything into a pill. And what's really cool is that this was an open label study that we'll be publishing later on in the summer, kind of 12 to 45 years of age, male, female, mild to moderate acne. And we basically saw roughly, so comedonal, like non-inflammatory lesion reduction of 49%, so almost 50% in 8 weeks, and the inflammatory, so pimples, about 58% decrease in 8 weeks. So we're super excited because this is substantial.
Yeah, that's huge. That's really huge. I mean, through, you know, when you think about supplements, you don't really understand like what, you know, what role they're playing, but you guys are, I think, almost approaching it from a very, you know, clinical standpoint, it sounds like, you know, it's really interesting to see that data.
Exactly. Cool. No, I think it is. No, I think, and so we're excited because, you know, we might be able to get comparable data to antibiotics.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very promising. I mean, and you know, you had mentioned microbiome modulation, and I'm very curious about this because, you know, I think it also depends on, like, you know, what we consider to be true pathogens versus commensal organisms. And so, you know, I would love to just hear your thoughts on this idea of, you know, C. acnes, you know, like, are all strains the same? I mean, is there a difference? Should we be, you know, targeting certain strains more than others? I mean, what are your thoughts around that?
So, you know, Cutibacterium acnes just by its name sounds like it'll trigger acne, right?
Yeah.
But what most people don't realize, it's actually a natural part of our skin microflora. So it's there, you know, even if we don't have acne. And it actually, certain strains have an important role in maintaining skin health. So what's interesting is, as you mentioned, you know, some strains are, quote, the good bacteria, the commensals. So there's about 9 strains in total. And most of them are actually commensal. The pathogenic ones so far that have been identified are 1A2 and 1B1. So really out of the 9, most of them appear to be good bacteria. And so, you know, stating that C. acnes causes acne is an overgeneralization. And so this is why, again, this whole genome sequencing of the microbiome and looking at the strain level rather than the species level is so important, because we don't want to kill off the beneficial bacteria, which help actually prevent acne, and that actually keep in check the virulent strains. And so basically, the other thing that's really interesting about C. acnes is that it will change its behavior based on its environment. So some of these virulent strains, if they're on the surface of the skin and there's plenty of oxygen there, because, you know, they're exposed to air, they don't overpopulate. But if they're stuck in a pore and the pore is plugged, so there's no oxygen, it's an oxygen poor environment. Oh, and there's sebum in there. Oh, they go crazy. And so they basically, it's almost like a switch is flipped in the bacteria and they exponentially multiply. And that's your pimple.
Wow. So it does matter, like where they are, you know, if it's the surface, like you said, you know, you're constantly exposed to oxygen and you're getting killed off if you're causing damage. Is that what you're saying? Or
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. So they're kind of like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde bacterium. So, you know, when you think of the hair follicle, your sebocytes in there, they excrete the skin sebum, the skin oil that's normally comes out of the hair follicle, coats the upper layer of the skin, that helps reinforce your skin barrier, protects your skin from other bacteria, pollution. So, and it's also nutrients for other parts of your skin microbiome, the bacteria that like fat, the lipophilic bacteria. But if there's too much, you know, it goes back to the balance. If there's too much of a good, you know, good thing, and there's too much sebum in the hair follicle, then, you know, and you have dead skin cells, which is another kind of symptom of acne, is how your follicle, the follicular death of your skin cells, and they form plugs. And then once it's plugged, then there's no more oxygen. And then you get this basically crazy exponential growth of the acne's bacterium, of those virulent strains, I should say, of the acne's bacterium.
That makes sense. That's so fascinating. It's just so fascinating to think about that on that level, because I think we don't really do that. If you're somebody who suffers from acne, I mean, how much time do you spend really thinking about, you know what I mean, like what's causing this? And that really leads me to asking a bigger question, Barbara, in the sense of like, is acne really a problem that has to do with like a bacterial disease, or is it inflammation? You know, like if you could clarify that, because I know that you had mentioned earlier, you know, you were talking specifically about IL-10, but even other cytokines that might be more pro-inflammatory, like IL-1 alpha, IL-6, IL-8, I mean, what is their role and how does this all really work?
So you're absolutely right, Ekta, to bring out that acne is also an inflammatory disease. Yes, there are certain strains of, you know, bacteria like the C. acnes strains that we mentioned, but it's actually, we should think of it as a bigger like acne inflammasome, because that's what actually starts the development of the acne lesions because of that inflammatory response, just as you stated, the IL-6, the IL-8, the IL-1A, and it's a tumor necrosis factor that basically causes the cell death to have these dead cells in the follicle that then plug it. So once it's activated, the problem is that, as you said, it releases these pro-inflammatory molecules that basically stimulates the sebocytes, so the oil-producing cells in the follicle, to go crazy. And so they produce a lot of oil that basically disrupts the normal shedding at the edge of the follicle. Well, normally that oil would come out. And then this biological storm, basically that clogs your pore, and then you're back to the acne overgrowth. So, you know, if the pore is just kind of a sebum and it's still open to the air, then that's your whitehead. If it gets oxidized, it's your blackhead. And then if it gets clogged with the dead skin cells and the acne basically multiplies in there, that's your pus-filled pimple. So really it's, and the more you have chronic inflammation in the rest of your body, the more that chronic inflammation can impact your hair follicles. And so, yeah, so as you said, it's really back to the pro-inflammatory molecules. And then they also can compromise the local skin barrier around it. And so that's why you get these red inflammations. Like, you know, when you have that acne pimple and there's like red around it, that's basically the body telling you there's inflammation.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. And you know, what's interesting is that this, you mentioned the barrier, because, you know, we always talk about that, how acne really compromises your skin barrier, you know, and it's something that is talked about, but then, you know, not really, I think, understood, because, you know, there's things like water loss that I think everybody knows about, you know, that water escapes and you get dryness and, you know, whatever. But I mean, how does the impaired barrier really contribute to overall acne and the related problems?
So that's actually a really interesting point, Ekta, because a lot of the acne products, like whether they're salicylic acid washes or benzoyl peroxide spot treatments, they strip all the oil off of your skin. And so they're basically stripping that protective layer that prevents the dehydration in your skin. So they are affecting your skin barrier. And then the more your skin barrier is impacted, the more that drives, again, the inflammation. And yeah. The moment you weaken the skin barrier, it's more porous again. So we're back to that leaky skin, and that allows irritants or allergens or bacteria to penetrate your skin more easily, which causes more inflammation and more skin damage. So there's this really negative cycle if you don't keep your skin well hydrated while you're on an acne treatment, and that delays healing because the hindered skin barrier basically will not only take longer to heal, but then you can have scarring and you can have infection. So you really do need to, I think it's really important to note that if you do have acne and you're using some of these kind of more aggressive products, to really keep good control of your skin hydration and to use a non-comedogenic moisturizer.
Interesting. That's very interesting. Yeah. So I guess, you know, because that's actually, you know, I think a lot of people think the opposite for some reason when it comes to acne. Like they're like, no, I don't want to put anything on my skin that's going to, like, you know, cause too much moisture or any kind of oils or anything on there where they think it's going to occlude their skin. And it's almost like, no, you have to keep that moisture in balance, you know? So that makes sense what you're saying. I mean, I think that's a note for anyone out there who might be scared to use, you know, more moisturizing products when you are suffering from acne, and just keep a note of it, I guess.
And I would also say to anybody on Accutane or isotretinoin, because that dries out your sebaceous glands, like that basically dries out your hair follicles. And so you don't have that oil coming on your skin. So it goes back to the skin barrier now being dry or not, you know, not having that lipid part of the skin barrier. Then a lot of people who are on Accutane for a long time end up with eczema. For that very reason, because they get that leaky skin, then that leaking skin triggers a different inflammatory cascade. And, you know, you've gone from one problem to another.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's really about, again, you know, balance. I mean, really all of this comes down to balance. And I just find it so interesting that we get scared by, you know, anything that feels like, or I guess the word occlusive, you know,
yep,
like, it's exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, but that's very, very interesting. Now I want to actually talk a little bit about, because earlier, you know, when you were explaining the gut to skin, and then we talked about the brain a little bit, I had mentioned it makes me think of endocrine, right? So I want to ask you about hormonal acne and how is that different from bacterial acne that we were discussing just now?
Oh, you're right. So we should probably talk. Yeah, we should talk about hormonal acne. So yeah, so bacterial acne, I think we've covered, you know, that's the overgrowth of cutibacterium acnes and basically excess sebum. And it's the whiteheads, blackheads, pustules, you know, pimples, basically anywhere on the face, back, or chest. That also can have to do with, you know, sweating, cleaning, changing your bed sheets, you know, so basically, and it's way more responsive to topical treatments. So yeah. Things like salicylic acid and benzoyl peroxide or sulfur. Hormonal acne, on the other hand, is usually induced by hormonal imbalance. So as you said, it ties back to basically the endocrine system. And that actually, it's interesting. It typically appears in women on the jaw, chin, and neck. Or maybe the upper back, but not like the lower back. And again, you get your typical pimples, blackheads, and whiteheads. But it's so obviously we know during adolescence and puberty we have it, but then women can get it every month with their menstrual cycle. It can be triggered by pregnancy or it can be triggered by menopause. And there it's really the excess of androgens and possibly stress hormones like cortisol that again increase the sebum production. So back to the oily skin and increasing then the colonization of the sea acne. So there is obviously a bacterial component to it, but the thing is it's triggered actually by the hormones causing the oil production.
Interesting. So what about like something like PCOS? Because PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, I don't know, for all the listeners out there, I know that more and more women are being affected by this now, more so than ever. You know, I feel like the numbers keep going up for this disease. And I mean, how does that play a role in terms of hormonal acne?
Yeah, you're right, Ekta. It does influence about 1 in 10 women of childbearing age. So it and maybe we're just diagnosing it more and we're more aware of it. But
yeah.
In PCOS, you have elevated levels of male hormones. So these are androgens like testosterone that are the most common. And then you also have a higher than average sensitivity to progesterone. Oftentimes, PCOS is associated with irregular menstrual cycles. You may have excessive hair growth in certain areas, weight gain, and the worst cases, ovarian cysts. But hormonal acne is a comorbidity with PCOS. Now, not all women with PCOS will experience hormonal acne. And for those that do, the severity can vary. However, the PCOS hormonal imbalances do typically increase the likelihood, but also the severity of the acne. And so It's always worse around menstrual periods, and it tends to appear more as like cysts and kind of these tender knots that are underneath your skin rather than the fine surface bumps of bacterial acne. So it's harder to treat because you can't just put a topical on it and have it go away. But I think today, these usually require medical interventions. So dermatologists often recommend, you know, contraceptives, spironolactone, which is ironically a high blood pressure drug that was developed for men that's now used off-label to treat hormonal acne, lifestyle changes. And you can, in fact, manage a good piece of it with supplements and the right skincare routine.
Right. Now, it's interesting you brought up spironolactone, though, because spironolactone is... You're right. It's a very interesting drug. And I know with PCOS, it is actually prescribed pretty readily, you know, and the treatment because of its effects on acne, like you said, and also hair, you know, just the hair that grows. Like I have PCOS. So I know that there's a lot of like, you know, other things that happen, including like, you know, we call it hirsutism in medicine, but really it's like induced hirsutism in this disease where you're having like chin growth of hair, you know, or whatever. And these are other side effects. And so they give you spironolactone because it's supposed to check all of that, you know, it's supposed to bring all of that in balance, but I don't know how effective it is. And that's why I'm asking, like, you know, is there an alternative to this? You know, has Codex, you know, found an alternative, I should ask?
So what I would say for severe hormonal acne, not yet. And yeah, a lot of that is now treated also with laser treatments where the laser is used to shrink the sebaceous gland. But I would say for mild to moderate acne, yes. So again, we just got the data back from our clinical trial that we did on our SHOT skin de-stress supplement. And we were able to reduce hormonal acne lesions by about 61% over 8 weeks. So that's really two menstrual cycles. And it's based on kind of key ingredients. So you could think of as hormonal balancing ingredients that are like inositol or myonositol, and that's carbocyclic that mediates cell signaling in response to hormones. And it's used actually in the management of PCOS. It's often a supplement that is given for women with PCOS because it reduces plasma testosterone and free testosterone, as well as insulin, because insulin resistance can again cause chronic inflammation, like we were talking about the high sugar diet and acne. And also we have folic or pantothenic acid. So we all are familiar with, you know, high doses of folic acid before pregnancy, but this vitamin, you know, B5 is used basically to improve insulin resistance and also decrease testosterone levels. So the inositol and the folic acid are there to decrease testosterone levels. And then we have L-theanine, which is a amino acid from green and black tea, for example, or mushrooms. And that actually modulates brain function to reduce stress and anxiety related symptoms. And this has been shown to reduce cortisol, which is again, another hormone that can then lead to androgens and hormonal acne. So those three are kind of the key three ingredients of the supplement.
Wow. So in terms of, you know, the anti-inflammatory plants from Ayurveda, can you give us some examples of that?
Oh, I forgot. Yeah, good point, Ekta. So the supplement also contains anti-inflammatories. And since Sean is based on Ayurveda, there are, because inflammation, right, we were talking about how some of these higher androgen levels can also lead to chronic inflammation. So we have holy basil. Some people call it Tulsi. And again, it's anxiety, stress, and depression relieving component of Ayurveda. But also, again, it's been associated with decreases in glucose levels, as well as inflammation and joint pain. Then there's turmeric, which we're all, I think, familiar with for its anti-inflammatory properties. Milk thistle. So milk thistle is slightly different because that one contains silymarin, which is an antioxidant that targets the liver and also has anti-inflammatory properties. But what we want to do is use something that will target liver clearing. And what's interesting is there are now studies showing that its properties are similar to doxycycline. So it goes back to the antibiotic, you know, finding plants that have similar effects to the antibiotics. And then the last one is barberry. And that's another anti-inflammatory antioxidant that basically really there, it's the anti-lipogenics, again, the anti-high fat effect of barberry on the sebaceous glands. So try to reduce, calm those glands that produce the oil. So it's kind of a combination of antioxidants, but also things that help with essentially the high sugar, the high fat diet. And wow, then also have MSM. So MSM is not an Ayurvedic plant, but it's a methylsulfonylmethane is a great naturally occurring organosulfur. And so it's basically a chemical compound that reduces inflammation. People use it typically for joint and muscle pain, but we use it in this case to lower the chronic inflammation.
That is so fascinating. I love the Shant collection, by the way, Barb. Like it's one of my favorite like collections in skincare, because I remember when I first tried it, I think it was the mask. I mean, this is a little like, you know, side note for our listeners, but the first product in the Shant collection I tried was your your mask, and it made such a huge difference on the inflammation I was experiencing on my face. And I just immediately, I was like, yeah, they're really onto something, you know, like this is going to be huge, this collection. So I'm really excited to hear that, you know, that there is this true anti-inflammatory property here, you know,
well,
these
I have
supplements.
To send you some of the supplement for your PCOS. You have to check it out, Acta.
Yeah, no,
you.
I have to get on it actually, you know, because it's a big problem. PCOS, I mean, I think, you know, I say PCOS, but it's very, very hard to treat. And it's crazy because medicine right now, I mean, that's why I'm so glad you had brought up spironolactone, because we really don't have anything that is targeting the overall symptoms and the true endocrine disruption that's there in PCOS. And so it's very fascinating that, you know, the data that you've been sharing, because, you know, this would be a game changer for so many women out there, you know, and not in terms of even acne, but the fertility implications of this. I mean, it's really an uphill battle. Like right now I can share, you know, for our listeners, if anyone's interested, I'm going through the whole fertility journey myself, you know, and it's a problem. Like even when you go through IVF and you're trying to do, I mean, PCOS will impact every part of your life. And so to have something that you can take and you know it's going to make a difference, you know, here we're talking about acne, but in general, this is a very hard disorder, you know what I mean, to treat. So very, very fascinated by what you guys are doing in that realm. But I wanted to ask you, do you have any clinical study results for the supplement that you could share? And how
Absolutely.
It might, you know, compare as well to the other
Yeah,
ones?
So we did another open label study on basically more hormonal acne with this supplement. And so it was, again, over 8 weeks because we wanted to hit at least, we probably should have done 12 weeks, but it was, again, kind of mild to moderate acne. And here we saw, this was actually crazy. So on the comedones, like the non-inflammatory regions, we saw about 30% at 4 weeks and 60% at 8 weeks. And then for the inflammatories, within a month, we saw 55% decrease. And then it was like a 60% decrease at 8 weeks. So you can really start seeing results at 4 weeks. And, you know, they're in the 60s in the 8 weeks. So again, they're very comparable with the probiotics, although it was faster for the inflammatory lesions, probably because the hormonal regulation happens much faster. It's a faster cycle than clearing out your gut and reducing overall inflammation. But I think this really demonstrates the potential of these kinds of supplements for hormonal acne. And again, we're gonna be running a head-to-head kind of double-blind study against spironolactone. So we have one study where we're gonna pit our probiotic against an antibiotic, and then we're gonna pit this supplement against spironolactone.
Wow, that is so exciting. I am so excited and I'm so happy that you're doing this. Like, I cannot tell you. I mean, this is game changing. And I feel like, you know, this is exactly the kind of route that we should be taking at this point with skin health, because I was having a conversation, you know, previously with somebody else about the really harsh drugs, you know, used for acne. I mean, how many times do we talk about Accutane, right? I mean, it's like the first thing that comes out of anyone's mouth when they are talking about true like cystic acne or anything like a severe case. And I remember having this conversation and being like, why? Like, why are we still doing that when we should be developing new opportunities and new, you know, solutions, I should say. So this is very, very amazing work. And I really applaud you for doing this. Thank you for sharing everything today. It's been so fascinating to learn.
Well, thank you so much, Acta. Yeah, hopefully we can prove it, you know, against these traditional medical treatments for moderate acne. And then of course, the last bastion is severe acne and cystic acne.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you will. This is very, very promising data. So for everyone listening, if you have not already checked out Codex Lab and their whole collection, I really urge you guys to do so. And if you have any questions at all from this episode or any of the knowledge that Dr. Powell just shared here with us, please feel free to chime in and let us know and we will pass on your questions. But thank you so much, Barb. This has been such an honor once again to host you and to learn from you.
Thank you so much, Hector.